So when Hank asked me to give this talk about neutrinos from gamma regressors, I was not so happy, because he wanted me to explain what gamma ray bursts are, why they have jets, what are the questions of high energy particles production, and why this is related to gamma ray bursts, and so on. Yeah.
Good Lord, thank you.
And it's so I will try to do some of this. Basically, to explain three main things. One is why high energies are interesting at all. Why we're interested in them. Then I would talk about gamma ray bursts and jets, and try to explain why we believe gamma ray bursts are intimately related to jets. And you've heard all the details you probably didn't want to hear last week, so I'll try to just talk about the most basic things without going into any of the details. And then I will argue that gamma ray bursts have something to do with high energy particles, and therefore these jets must be related to these high energy particles. Okay, and please stop me at any time if you have questions. I'm supposed to give you this overview of both high energy particles, jets in GRBs, and high energy particles in GRBs. Okay, so we start with the first question: why high energy are interesting at all? So this is a very schematic description of the cosmic ray spectrum as we measure it here on Earth. This is a differential flux as a function of energy. And we have three regimes here, as you can see. At low energies, we have a flux decaying as e to the minus 2.7. There's a steepening at around 10 to the 15 electron volts, which is usually called the knee, where the spectrum steepens to an e to the minus 3 dependence. And then at roughly 10 to the 19 electron volts, there is a flattening. This is usually called the ankle. And this last component here seems to be a new component kicking in after a lower energy component is dying out. Now, as far as composition, at the lowest energy, the cosmic rays are mainly protons. And as you go to higher energies, the fraction of heavy nuclei increases. Okay, we have evidence, although this is still controversial and uncertain, that at the highest energies, the composition becomes lighter again. Okay. Now, at low energies, particularly at, let's say, roughly 10 to the 18 electron volts, we see anisotropy in the cosmic ray flux associated with the galactic plane. There seems to be an enhancement in the galactic plane, and this disappears at higher energies. So the common thinking, although not everyone agrees with that, is that at the highest energies, we have an extragalactic source of light nuclei. Okay, and I will not go into the discussions of whether this is correct or how robust this conclusion is, but for now, I will just assume that we have an extragalactic source of very high energy light nuclei, presumably protons.
Sorry, what's the energy of the galactic plane enhancement?
At a few times 10 to the 18 electron volts, you see it's a small enhancement, but statistically it's highly significant.
Is this Argassian sugar, something completely galactic
plane? It's completely galactic plane, yeah. I think it's also in high res. Yeah. Now, just as a note for later, the reason that this business is related to neutrinos, to high-energy neutrinos, is that sources that produce high-energy protons are likely also to produce neutrinos. High-energy protons can interact with photons or with other nucleons to produce charged pions, and these charged pions, when they decay, produce high-energy neutrinos. Okay, so the existence of these high-energy protons implies that they are accelerators of high-energy particles, and we expect them to produce high-energy neutrinos, and I'll get back to that towards the end of this talk. Okay, now why this is interesting? This is something I've already shown in the lunch Blackboard discussion on last Monday. So just very briefly, the main reason that these particles are interesting and probably interesting to you is related to the acceleration. As I mentioned, charged particles are accelerated in astrophysical sources by letting them go down some potential drop, and the potential is usually produced by the motion of magnetized plasma. So we have a source and we have an outflow characteristic velocity V of magnetized plasma characteristic field B. And if you have a circle of radius R around this source, the potential drop across the circle is given by the time derivative of the magnetic flux, okay, which is easy to estimate. So you get this potential to be the product of the magnetic field, the size, and the velocity normalized to that of the speed of light. Okay, so this potential implies that you can accelerate particles, charged particles, up to the charge of the particle times the potential drop. So for a given B times R, you have an upper limit to the energy of the particle.
What's the particle from going around twice?
From?
Going around twice.
Well, in principle, it can go many times around, but you would not. This is the total potential drop. Even if you let it go many times, it would not gain more.
You can't do it.
Hmm?
You can't get around that by scattering.
Or? This is the maximum potential that the source produces. You cannot accelerate to more than the potential.
And it's not more than the size of the system.
Yeah, that's right. But this is not the point. Even if it were confined, you would not gain more than the potential drop. This will stop it from going more than once. Yeah, that's right.
Beyond a certain energy, it can't go around the escape
also. This is what Chuck was saying, and this is true. Now, if you want to achieve a certain energy, then from this you get immediately a lower limit on the luminosity of the source. The energy density of the magnetic field, okay, times the velocity is the rate at which energy is carried away from the source per unit area. You multiply by the area, you get a lower limit to the luminosity. The luminosity is probably higher because the magnetic field energy density is only part of the total plasma energy density. And since we have a lower limit to this product, we have a lower limit to this luminosity for a given energy. And here I assume, let's say, this is a proton with a charge, which is simply the electron charge. And I explained also in the lunch board talk that when the flow is relativistic, you get an additional gamma squared factor. I will not repeat it now. So putting in numbers, you get the slower limit to the luminosity for a 10 to the 20 electron volt proton. You have a few times 10 to the 45 arcs per second for this ideal source where gamma and beta are both close to unity. And as you all know, there are not too many examples that can satisfy this constraint. Essentially, we have two classes of sources that can possibly do that. The steady sources, the brightest ones, are active galactic nuclei with Lorentz factors of a few. You need luminosities of 10 to the 47 arcs per second, so perhaps the brightest AGN can do that. And the brightest transient sources are GRBs. They have Lorentz factors of a few hundred, so they need luminosities of 10 to the 51 arcs per second, which is below what we believe to be the characteristic GRB luminosity. So the challenge is obvious. We need to explain how these particles are accelerated. We don't have too many potential sources. And as you know, AGNs, of course, are producing jets, and if the acceleration takes place, it takes place in these jets. So this is why you should be interested in that. And the next point I'll try to show you is why we believe GRBs are also producing jets, and why we believe that if particles are accelerated in GRBs, they're also accelerated in the jets of these objects. And then you would all start working on particle acceleration in jets. Okay. So this was a very quick summary of what I explained in the lunch talk. So now the main part is why GRBs and jets are related, and I'll try to convince you that we know that all the observed characteristics, all the observed phenomena that we see from GRBs are associated with jets. So very briefly, one slide summary of the gamma ray phenomenology of GRBs. GRBs are short flashes of hard photons, MEV photons. Durations range from a fraction of a second to hundredths of a second. And broadly speaking, they are divided into two categories, the short ones with durations clustering around 0.2 seconds, and long ones with durations clustering around 20 seconds. Variability in some cases, for bright bursts, very bright bursts, we can see variability to short timescales, and variability is seen to millisecond timescales and sometimes even to shorter timescales. And this is an example of the flux as a function of time for one particular GRB. You see these very narrow spikes, and you see this event is highly variable, doesn't appear to show any simple time behavior. Okay, the spectra are highly non-thermal. Most of the energy comes in photons around and above an MEV. And in some cases, again, where the bursts are bright enough and we were lucky enough for them to fall within the field of view of high energy instruments, we have spectra extending to 100 MeV and sometimes even to higher energies. So this is an example. You see this spectrum extending up to 100 MeV in this case, with number of photons per unit energy dropping like one of the energy squared here, which implies equal energy per logarithmic energy beam of the photons. Okay, you know that the distribution is complete.
Maximum spectra is a few hundred keV, not
the where most of the energy is emitted.
Yes,
yeah, a few hundred keV times 2.5 for the redshift. It's about an MeV.
2.5.
Well, 1 + z is 2.5. Or maybe 3. 1 plus z is, the typical redshift of a GRB is 1.5.
Yes, but those which have redshift less than unity also have the same spectrum.
This is not, what do you mean? They have.
I mean, if z is 0.1 or 0.2, it's, they also have maximum.
Right, so the few hundred keV that you mentioned is the characteristic energy in our frame observed on Earth, right? And that the characteristic redshift is 1.5, so you need to multiply this by 2.5 in order to get the photon energy in the rest frame.
Also, we don't have good calorimetry of greater than 100 MeV, so there could be significant energy at greater than 100 MeV.
Oh yeah, of course. We don't. Well, this is what we don't see. You're not happy. You're not happy.
Some have tails, some don't have tails. So it's not the general
characteristic
of the GRB, whatever it is.
The bursts that show no tails are actually a minority fraction in the distribution. But I don't want to go into all these details. So it's less than 30% that don't have high energy tails. Okay. So the first argument for them being cosmological, as you know, was this isotropic distribution over the sky. And if you put a typical cosmological distance, you get an energy assuming isotropic emission of 10 to the 52 ergs. Now, based on these observations, a model was constructed for the production of these events. And just very briefly, again, one slide, go through the arguments and what the model is. So the rapid variability implies that the source is small, light millisecond across. The energy that is emitted, which is a fraction of a solar rest mass, suggests then that the source of the energy is gravitational collapse of solar mass or a few solar mass objects into a black hole. This would give you a sufficiently compact object. It would release sufficient amount of energy. So the general thinking is that the source, okay, driving these explosions is the gravitational collapse of a few solar mass objects into a black hole. Now, the duration of this of the long events are tens of seconds. This is much longer than the dynamical time of the collapse of a few solar mass objects into a black hole, which is milliseconds, which is the variability time. So this suggests that the energy is released not directly by the initial collapse, but perhaps by an accretion disk of matter which was left after this collapse, and this disk gradually accretes onto the black hole, producing the long duration of the emission and allowing for a very short variability timescale. The great advantage of this model is, of course, that we have no idea how to calculate the viscous time of the disk, so we say it's 10 seconds and it nicely fits the observations. Okay. Now, the emission of such large amount of energy in such a small volume produces a very hot, optically thick plasma. The optical depth for pair production in this plasma is huge. So what is produced is a fluid of photons, electrons, and positrons, essentially. And this fluid has very high pressure, so it starts to expand and accelerate. Now, the fact that we have observed these 100 MeV photons suggests that the plasma, when it emits the gamma rays, must be moving with a Lorentz factor of larger than 100. The main point is that you want to get the restroom energy of these photons to be lower than MeV so that they would not produce pairs and be absorbed. Okay. And now, the mechanism by which the gamma rays are produced is believed to be dissipation at some large radius from the central object. So you produce this plasma and you produce this essentially wind. You have a wind which lasts for tens of seconds with variability time of milliseconds. So the wind is probably very inhomogeneous. This leads to expansion with different velocities, slightly different velocities, which lead to collisions at some very large radius. These collisions lead to dissipation of energy, which is then radiated as gamma rays. And the most popular model is acceleration of electrons in these shock waves to high energies. And we believe that these electrons are producing the gamma rays by synchrotron and inverse Compton emission.
Aren't you missing something in your diagram, the supernova remnant shell?
Well, why complicate things? Right?
But you can't have an isolated few solar mass thing collapsing to a black hole. That's like a physical impossibility. It has to start out in something like 10, at least tens or 100 solar mass object. Well, okay, I guess neutron star mergers or something, I guess.
Right, so I don't want to discuss what the progenitor that collapses to a black hole is now.
Yes,
it's out.
It's a big star or something.
It's either a big star or it's a merger, right? We now think it's more likely to be a big star, but this is not relevant for our talk. I mean, all this remains the same, whatever complications you will just raise. So. Okay, so one of the predictions of this scenario was, the emission of an afterglow. So after you are done with all this gamma ray production, you are still left with the plasma, which is moving relativistically. And this plasma, at some point, would feel the ambient medium, whatever it is. It would send a shock wave into this ambient medium. This shock wave would also accelerate electrons to high energies. And these electrons would radiate and produce X-ray, UV, and radio photons as the shock wave decelerates. So at early times, it produces X-rays, then UV, optical, and radio. And as you all know, this has been detected. This afterglow has been detected, so it is a nice confirmation or nice success of the model. And the evidence we have for these events being jets comes from this part of the evolution, and I'll therefore now concentrate on this part only. Okay, so. In order to explain what we learn and how we learn it from the afterglow observations, I'll show you a few slides of the basic arguments. So suppose that we have a spherical explosion. Suppose we dump some large amount of energy in, let's say, the interstellar medium, and you know that this leads to an expanding blast wave, a spherical shock wave. So like in the Sedov case, which is the case for a non-relativistic explosion, okay, the dynamics, or let's say the radius of the shockwave as a function of time, is simply determined by the energy that was released and the number density of the surrounding medium. This is simply conservation of energy. Okay, and this is also true For the relativistic case, the Lorentz factor of the expansion is simply determined by the energy and the number density with some constants. And the thing that you may want to remember is that if you release 10 to the 53 ergs of energy and number density of 1 per cubic centimeter, you get a Lorentz factor of about 100 at a radius of 10 to the 17 centimeters. Now, the only complication in this picture is related to time delays. So for an observer sitting somewhere, let's look at photons emitted from the line of sight, then you know that due to the relativistic expansion, the time at which a photon emitted from a radius r reaches the observer is delayed compared to that of a photon emitted from the center by r divided by gamma squared c, because the difference between the velocity and that of light is 1 over gamma squared. And if you do some more elaborate calculations, you get that the correct factor to put here is 4. Okay? And the other point to notice is that because of this relativistic expansion, we don't see emission from radial expansion in directions which make an angle which is larger than 1 over the Lorentz factor with respect to our line of sight. But if we take this point here, for example, due to the relativistic expansion, most of the photons are emitted in a cone of opening angle which is 1 over the Lorentz factor. So if this angle, theta, is larger than 1 over the Lorentz factor, none of these photons would reach the observer. And this implies two things. One, the time delay of this photon compared to this photon is also r divided by gamma squared. So all the photons emitted from radius r reach us at r divided by gamma squared. And the second point is that the size, the apparent size of this object is not r, but r divided by gamma. Now we have a direct confirmation of this picture from a measurement of this size here, of the apparent size of the source. Now 10 to the 17 centimeter is a tiny size for a cosmologically distant source, but as you know, this was measured using scintillation. So I'll just mention this very briefly. You know what the scintillations are. You have the gamma ray burst here, the observer here, and you have free electrons in the galaxy on the way. So radio waves are being scattered, and if the scattering angle is large enough so that the displacement of a ray is larger than the coherence length of the perturbation in the or the fluctuations in the electron density, we get multiple images of the source, and this would cause diffractive scintillation. The nice thing about this is that in order to get diffractive scintillation, the source must be point-like. If the source is extended, then different points on the source, produce different diffraction maps at the observer, and if these diffraction maps do not overlap, they would just smear out and you would not see any diffractive scintillation. Now, it turns out, by luck, that the critical size for a source to produce diffractive scintillation, or the size beyond which the scintillation is suppressed, is 10 to the 17 centimeters, and this is exactly the size of this expanding fireball after 1 week. And so the prediction was that as we look at the radio wavelengths, we should see rapid variability of the flux up to 1 week roughly, and then this variability should be suppressed because the source expands beyond that size. Another important point is that since the phase accumulated by these deflections is strongly dependent on wavelength, the diffraction pattern here varies very quickly with frequency. So these fluctuations should be uncorrelated in wavelength. And this is exactly what was observed. This is the logarithm of the ratio of radio fluxes at 9 and 5 gigahertz as a function of time. You see these very rapid fluctuations settling down on a constant ratio at some time. So this means that the size of this object is consistent with the prediction of the model after a few weeks.
The number depends on the turbulence of this screen, or
which number? This number.
Yeah,
this few depends on the details of the density fluctuations in the interstellar medium, And so this is why I can only write a few here and not a more exact number. There are some directions in the galaxy through which you know this number more accurately from pulsar observations. There are some directions that you don't know it so well.
For calculation you're seeing from Oberon, something like that?
No, from the calculation I just took the determined value from regions near that direction. Yeah.
What burst is this one?
97058.
There's been no other observation since then about a wave that shows diffractive scintillation that dissipates.
Well, there has been, but not as good as this one. This had this was fairly close, and the radio flux was fairly high, so you could do these measurements very accurately. It's not. The sub-Miljansky sources, so it's not so easy to do. And we have another direct measurement of the size. This is from a burst which happened to be very nearby at redshift of 0.17. So this is very unusual. It is so close that 10 to the 17 centimeters could be resolved by very large baseline interferometry. And what you see here, this is the 22 gigahertz map. Okay, and the size inferred from this, okay, corresponds to 3.4 10 to the 17 centimeters, and this was 24 days after the burst. You can compare it to this prediction of the fireball model. Again, a nice confirmation of the dynamics that I've described to you.
Okay. Do they see it expand in time? Do they keep watching it?
Yeah, they have actually. They have seen it expanding, and then then you try to infer some things about maybe the density diffusion or things like that. This is, I think, much less certain. But this size is.
Is that like by self-absorption or something, or synchrotron self-absorption? The size
that you see. Why synchrotron self-absorption?
I would think
you see a source which
at higher and higher frequencies, you might see something smaller and smaller due to self-absorption, depending on.
Well, self-absorption is larger at lower frequencies. As you go to higher frequencies, it becomes optically thin.
Right, so you can see further.
But anyway, even
you see closer and closer in, so at higher frequencies, you see it getting smaller.
Well, you see.
If there's a gradient in the field.
Right, so let's say that what they saw is the radius of the sphere which emits 22 gigahertz radiation. Now, this is supposed to be the edge of the shock where you get most of the emission, right? So,
I thought we're looking down the jet, so this is just a sideways expansion of the jet.
That's right. This is
just that just being 1/√C or √3C.
No, this is why I wrote this as I mentioned. What do you mean? No. This is the apparent size. The apparent size is gamma times C times T times 2. This is the apparent size of this. This is why I did this exercise here. The apparent transverse size is gamma times C times T. Okay?
So what's the supernormal velocity dimension?
It doesn't move. So it just expands. There's an upper limit on the proper motion of this thing. But so it just expands. So suppose that you. So far, I'm talking, assuming that we have a sphere. So the center doesn't move. The center doesn't move. It just expands.
No, but you said that they measure this supernormal expansion, or
expansion, yes, but not motion. So you see something that sits there and expands. So doesn't move.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wrote what the gamma is, right? So, superluminal expansion at 5C. Okay. So I just compared this H that they measured to 2 gamma CT. Okay.
Is it correct for spherical expansion?
Yes. No, for spherical. Now we're assuming it's all spherical. We'll get to the jets in 1 second. Okay.
We could observe something symmetrical.
Something like that, right.
No.
This is not well. There is no elongation detected. This is just barely resolved by the VLA. Right. They have a limit on the ratio of minor and major axis. It's consistent with one.
So So is this optically thin or optically thickening?
This is optically thin.
So the flux is decreasing.
Decreasing with time, with frequency.
Was it possible to catch the optically thick phase where the flux has gone up in time, or you just catch the thin phase?
These things are never optically okay. So for this relativistic expansion, the self-absorption frequency is time independent. So it is always around 1 gigahertz. So if you observe at high frequencies, you just see the decline of the flux. If you observe at low frequencies, you can see the self-absorption. I'll show you this in a few slides. Okay. Okay. Now, Y jets. Okay. So far we discussed this spherical expansion. But what if this thing is a jet and not a sphere? So the first point that I've already mentioned is that if we sit along the axis of the jet, as long as the opening angle of the jet is larger than 1 over the Lorentz factor, we don't know that this is a jet because we don't see anything from larger angles. Okay? So we are ignorant about this being a jet. The other point is that the jet itself is ignorant of him being a jet because the two sides of the jet are causally disconnected. Okay, so if you ask how much time it takes for this jet to expand to radius r, in our frame it's r over c, rather in the source frame it's r over c, but in the jet frame it's r divided by gamma c. So if you try to send a signal transversely, okay, the distance that it would propagate is going to be r over gamma. So again, as long as the opening jet of the angle is larger than 1 over gamma, you cannot get information from the sides of the jet into the center, so the jet behaves exactly as if it were a conical section of a sphere. Okay. Now this changes because the jet slows down, and at the time where the Lorentz factor drops to be 1 over the opening angle, the jet knows that it is not spherical, it feels the edges, and it starts expanding sideways. And this is easy to calculate. This would happen at this angle if the time is 1 day. Okay, so the main point to carry from this is that if the jet opening angle is like a tenth of a radian, then the time at which this sideways expansion would ensue is going to be roughly 1 day. Okay. Now, a comment for those that were worried about whether we see a sphere or a jet about the size. This is somewhat technical, but maybe worth mentioning since this was asked. So, as long as the Lorentz factor is large enough and we don't have this expansion, so we have a spherical expansion, then the apparent size is given by this equation that I've shown you earlier. Now, at later times, when the jet starts expanding, this behavior is modified, and it's modified to this behavior. The point is that the time dependence is very similar in the two cases. Okay, so it goes from t to the 5/8 to t to the half. So observationally, it's very difficult to discriminate between these two cases.
Even if the jet didn't start expanding, wouldn't you still see a break in the light curve just when you saw it to the edge of the jet?
Right. It's a combined effect of the two things.
Okay,
that's
so
right.
Two different things,
but they both combine to give you this a modification. Right. Now, the point I'm emphasizing here is that if you look at, let's say, the size measurement observations, the accuracy of those are not sufficient to discriminate between these two cases. Okay, so from that direct size measurement, we cannot determine whether this is a jet or a sphere, at least in my view. But this here, the fact that we start seeing that the jet has edges, both we as observers and both the jet itself, and therefore it starts expanding, okay, implies that there is a change in the decline of the flux at this time, and this has been observed. This is the famous example. You see that at roughly 1 day, just 10 to the 5 seconds, you see a change in the decline of the flux, and you see it in all frequencies at the same time. And this is interpreted as the jet break time, the time at which the jet and us know that there is a jet instead of a sphere. And from this type of light curves, we infer jet opening angles and so on. And as you see, it happens at roughly one day, which implies that the typical opening angles are a tenth of a radian.
Just want to make sure.
Yeah.
The inclusion of the jet expansion doesn't significantly change the inference of the jet opening angle over the standard equation that's used to infer. It doesn't affect it at all.
Well, don't believe any number they tell you to better than a factor of 2. Okay. Then it doesn't affect anything. Right. But I think this is the reality, because if you really want to calculate, you need to know the structure of the jet, you need the energy distribution in the jet, you need...
So you can infer the jet opening angle from these two factors,
right.
Yes.
But it's not really important, because is expansion lateral or not, it's after, right, the break, before it's spherical.
Well, in principle, it expands all the time, right? It expands also before... Because it already, so it's not just a delta function change. So if you do, you need to, if you want to do things to factor of 2, you need to know much more about the jet.
Yeah, this is what I was giving is an argument to say, right, that it does not.
Then you can ask Yoni.
Factor of 2 in time or in the angle?
In the angle, I would
because
say.
Because the angle depends quite quickly on time, right?
Yeah, but it depends more strongly on the assumptions. Right. Okay. Now, in order to give you the other evidence, and this is also would also be related to the particle acceleration, I want to say a few words about these collisionless shocks. So we have been discussing the shock wave propagating through the surrounding medium. If we sit at the shock rest frame, okay, then we have this ejecta of these protons that are moving in the observer frame very fast. Now here they are almost at rest, and then they see the protons from the ambient medium rushing very fast towards them. Okay, if you calculate the mean free path for Coulomb collisions of such shocks, okay, so we take a Coulomb collision for a relativistic proton, you'd find that the collision mean free path is the Hubble distance if you take the number density of the interstellar medium. Okay, so there is no way a shock wave would form here. Now, if you take nuclear cross sections, as some of our friends at the Technion like to do, you get several megaparsecs. So again, you would not get any shock wave out of that. So I remind you that the size of the system is like 10 to the 17 centimeters. So if you want to produce a shock wave, you have to have some process scattering these particles on distances much, much shorter than 10 to the 17 centimeters. And these processes will not do that. The process that will do that is what we call the plasma instabilities. So you have to remember that these protons are not alone. They are in groups. So we have a group of protons rushing into another group of protons. And if they just rush one through the other, this would be highly unstable. Plasma instabilities would develop. They would produce electromagnetic and electrostatic waves. And these would scatter the particles. And just as an order of magnitude estimate, the scale over which this would happen is the plasma skin depth, or the velocity of light divided by the ion plasma frequency. And this, for a number density of 1 per cubic centimeter, is 10 to the 7 centimeters. So this is very short. And this is probably the process that produces the shock waves that we see. Now, we don't know much about these collisionless shocks. We know that magnetic fields must be built up there in order to account for the observations and in order to allow the shocks to exist. But we don't know what fraction of the post-shock thermal energy is carried by these magnetic fields. So we have this phenomenological parameter, which we call epsilon sub b, which determines what fraction of the energy is in the magnetic field. Okay, and similarly, we don't know what fraction of the energy goes to relativistic electrons. So we have this parameter epsilon sub e, which determines how much energy goes into the electrons. And finally, we have very strong evidence, both theoretically and experimentally, that in this type of collisionless shocks, the particles are accelerated to a non-thermal distribution. So you have a power law extension of the energy of particles, number per logarithmic number per Lorentz factor drops like the Lorentz factor squared, roughly. Okay. Okay. So this is all I'm going to say about this. And it's too bad Angela is not here. She would see that, at least in this treatment, we nicely and explicitly denote the phenomenological uncertainties. Okay. This is for the record. It's recorded. Right. So if we take this model now to produce the radiation, we have the parameters that determine the dynamics, the energy, the number density, and possibly one additional parameter, which is the jet opening angle. These three parameters determine the dynamics. Then we have these parameters, epsilon A and epsilon B, which determine the radiation which would be emitted by this plasma. Okay? And P, I'm leaving out, we can measure it, but we also have good theoretical estimates of it. Okay, now, observationally, okay, we have four parameters, okay, forgetting about this jet break time, which would be a fifth one. But we have four parameters, and this is the characteristic synchrotron spectrum. There are three characteristic frequencies. One is the self-absorption frequency, which we already discussed. There is a frequency where the flux peaks. There is a frequency at which the electrons which emit the radiation cool on timescale faster than the expansion time of the jet. And we have a normalization, one overall normalization, which is the flux maximum. Okay. So if we have these four parameters, in principle, we can determine the four model unknowns. Okay. If you complicate it with the jet opening angle and P, then we have more observables that would determine those. And if you do that, you get typically this much of energy with this number density. This is not corrected for the opening angle of the jet. This is the azeotropic equivalent. And you get that significant fractions of the energy should be carried by electrons and magnetic fields. Okay.
This new N, you said normalization.
No, F, normalization is the flux level.
So mu M is
what? Mu M is the frequency at which the flux peaks.
Yeah, from a physical point of view, it's
a
breaking the injected spectrum.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's
the minimum energy of the electron.
It's the minimum energy of the injected electron.
So that's purely cooling in region 2.
No, no, this is purely cooling here. This is just the synchrotron spectrum of the non-cooled electrons. This is the cooled electrons.
Is it new to the one-third?
And this is new to the one-third. This is new to the one-third. This is new to the one-third, and this is self-absorption here. This is the upper limit. Right. So I don't want to go into too much of specifics here. And this injection issue is an open question, as we recently wrote about. Right. But forget all these complications. Okay. Now, this looks very good. This is a very nice spectrum. You have all these frequencies, and you have the normalization. The problem is that having such a good spectrum ranging from the radio to the X-rays is very rare. There are not too many examples of this. Actually, I think this is the only example. So usually, at least one of these parameters is not well known. The self-absorption frequency is not well known in most cases. So this is a nice exercise in principle. In practice, it's somewhat more difficult, but we'll not go into these details. Okay, so if we observe this jet early enough, before it knows it and we know that it is a jet, we can infer all these parameters. Okay? And this would be the energy that we would infer, assuming that it is spherically symmetric. Okay? Now we can wait for a long time and let the jet decelerate. Okay, and at some point it would become, it would expand, and at some point it would become subrelativistic. When it becomes subrelativistic, we see the entire emission from this object. Okay, so we are no longer confused by the beaming of the jet. Okay, so if we can measure, let's say, the energy of this explosion at the time where it is no longer relativistic, we have an absolute measurement of the energy. And by comparing this to the energy that we inferred at early times, we also have a good measurement of the opening angle. Okay. Now, the time at which this expansion becomes subrelativistic is roughly 1 year. And at this time, the emission peaks in the radio. So this implies that you need a very long observation. But this was done for several cases now. This is the first example. Okay, so this is 100 days, this is few years already, so you monitor these events in the radio for a very long time, and when you do that, this is the first example, there's another, there are a couple others now, you can determine the total explosion energy, you can determine the size from the radio observations, and you can infer the opening angle, okay, also from this exercise, comparing the early and late energies. Okay. The bottom line is that that everything seems to be consistent. So the energy after correcting for this beaming would be 10 to the 51 ergs roughly, and this is what is inferred from these calorimetric radio observations. The size that you expect for this energy and the expansion and so on is around 10 to the 18 centimeters. This is also what is measured. So we think that we have a good understanding of the, at least the dynamics of these explosions. Okay, so we are quite certain that we are talking about explosions which have 10 to the 51 ergs that are channeled into a jet with opening angle of roughly 0.1 radian, and that these explosions drive these shock waves that I've mentioned, and so on and so forth.
I just don't understand. I mean, these parameters you assumed are constant during the evolution?
No.
Epsilon,
B, epsilon. No. You determine them separately. You look at the late time radio observations, and from those you also determine epsilon E and epsilon B. Almost. This is what you see here. So, okay. This is for the more expert on the subject. From the late time radio observations, we only have actually three good observables. So one is a free parameter, let's say epsilon B. Okay? This is usually the case for radio supernovae. You don't know how to determine this, and you typically assume equipartition, right? But this is different, and this is what I try to show here. You have one free parameter, and here we took this free parameter to be the radius at the time of the observation. Okay, so you can get different solutions assuming different radii. The point is that if you take suppose some solution with some fixed radius, you need to invoke some energy in electrons and some energy in magnetic fields to account for the observations. Okay, so this curve is the sum of the electron and magnetic field energy. Okay, and as you all know, the minimum occurs typically roughly at equipartition. Okay, so if you go away from equipartition, okay, you get very large electron energy and very large magnetic field energy, or very large magnetic field energy. Now, this line here is the energy, okay, of this explosion that is required in order to get to this radius at the time of the observation from the set of Taylor solution. Okay, so obviously the electron and magnetic field energy densities cannot exceed the total energy in the explosion. So you are limited to this region here. Okay, so although there is some uncertainty, okay, it's fairly small. Okay, you cannot be far from equipartition. If you do the same plot for radio supernova, this curve, okay, the set of curves would sit somewhere up here, and then you would have very large uncertainty.
Sorry, what is
the dashed
line?
The dash is just 0.4 something of this thing. The thermal energy in the set of solution is 0.4 something of the total energy. So actually the electron and magnetic field, there's some kinetic energy, which should also be there. So you're actually limited to this range here.
So how many sources is good observation, I guess?
Guess.
Two.
No, three.
Three. Have you considered what might be happening to protons?
If they're accelerated and so on?
Or if there's any energy allocated to protons?
Oh, yeah. Okay. What we assume, this is just the total energy of the explosion. This would be the maximum that you can put into particles and magnetic fields.
All
particles. So if you want to limit yourself, then you would say, okay, the uncertainty is actually even smaller because it has to be here. But we want to be conservative, so we said, okay, somewhere around here.
That's nice when you put in the late time.
In the late time, yes, after a year or so. Right.
If you had inverse Compton earlier on, I mean, great, that degeneracy at earlier times or something, that would help. I mean, you could separately get the magnetic field or something.
Right, but It's very difficult to see the inverse component component at early times. In principle, yes.
If you assume that it's a sort of homogeneous otherwise.
Yeah. We always assume that. So this is order of magnitude estimates, but the main point is not that the exact values of the parameters, but more that we have different handles on the dynamics at different times, and it all fits together. All the observations that we have are all consistent with this very simple picture that I've described to you. Okay. Now, why high energy particles? So again, I will not go into details at all in this. This is the picture that you've seen earlier, and so far we've discussed what's going on out there. Now we would go back to discuss what's going on in the gamma ray production region. So I've mentioned that we believe that the radiation is due to acceleration of electrons in collision as shocks, which then emit synchrotron radiation. Okay. Now in the same region, if protons exist, they would be also accelerated. Should be also accelerated. So in principle, you can accelerate protons to very high energy. Now this has some connection to the question of what is the jet made of, okay? Which then has connection to the mechanism of the energy extraction. The common assumption is that the energy is carried away from the source as kinetic energy, so there are it's dominated by the kinetic energy of the baryons, and then you have these shock waves and so on. But there are other models where the energy is purely Poynting flux dominated. Oh, I see that there is a, this is misspelled there. Okay, drop the I. Then you would have no protons. Okay. So I will assume that you have these protons, see what we can do with that, and then in the end we'll say a few words about how we can actually determine whether there are protons or not from those neutrino observations. Okay, so if there are protons, they could be accelerated to very high energies. And I will just very briefly go over the argument. You can ask, suppose that you have this expanding plasma which expands at relativistic velocities and it is magnetized and so on. What requirements should be satisfied by this plasma in order for the electrons which are accelerated to produce MeV photons? You get a set of requirements. This set of requirements is written here. Okay? You need the magnetic field energy density to be at least a few percent of the electron energy density. You need the Lorentz factor to be a few hundred in order to avoid this destruction of the 100 MeV photons. And in order to account for the observations, you typically need the electrons to be accelerated to a power of 1 over e squared. Okay? You can do the same exercise and ask a different question. What would the requirement be that would allow the plasma to accelerate protons to 10 to the 20 electron volts? And then you get a different set of constraints, and then you can compare. So this you have already seen, this lower limit on the luminosity of the source, okay, that I've shown you, you've seen that it is satisfied by the gamma ray burst. But this is provided that the magnetic field is a significant fraction of the total energy. Otherwise, you need much, much larger energy. So the limit here is that the ratio should be, let's say, 20%. Okay, so comparable to this. Now, something that we did not discuss are losses. Now, in order that the protons, while being accelerated, not to lose all their energy by other processes, like by synchrotron processes, you need the expansion to be sufficiently fast. This reduces the energy density in the radiation and magnetic fields. So you get that the Lorentz factor should be larger than 100. So again, you get a very similar constraint, although these are derived by completely different arguments. I'll show you in just one slide that 1 over e squared spectrum for the protons would do well explaining the cosmic ray data. And finally, you can look at the global energetics. Okay. The rate at which high energy protons are produced in the universe is a few times 10 to the 44 or 10 to the 44 Earths per cubic megaparsec per year. And you can compare this to the rate at which energy is produced in gamma ray bursts in the universe. So what I've put here, these are the numbers that we had before the afterglow observations. So this is the 95 version. So we thought that the rate is this, and the energy per event is that, so we got this number. Now several things have changed since then, since the afterglow observations. One important thing is we know that they are more distant and more luminous. So this number went down, but this number came up. The product didn't change much. The main thing here is that we now have a much better estimate than we had before. So the error, if you want the error, the uncertainty in this number is much smaller than it used to be. And this relaxes somewhat this constraint. Now, we have some evidence from the afterglow observations, which is independent from the MEV observations. It's actually thanks to some work by Peter and Bing Zhang, showing that the plasma that is emitted by the source is highly magnetized. And we have also independent evidence that the Lorentz factor is large. Okay, so these afterglow observations did not, in that sense, change the picture, but it gave us more confidence that we have the right scenario and gave us a better handle on the parameters, and it all works in the right direction for this type of an exercise.
But the luminosity density for the protons refers to greater than 10 to the 20th eV protons or so.
No.
You might say 10 to the 19th.
No. So this is why I'm not writing. I'm writing E squared dNdE. So this is the energy per logarithmic energy beam of the particles. And I did the same for the electrons, which produce the gamma rays in the range that we see. So we need the same
energy. More energy if you assume that the ultra-high energy cosmic rays are producing the flux between 10 to the 17th and 10 to the 19th.
So you need, no. This is E squared dNdE. This is the spectral. So if you want to integrate over some region, you multiply the natural logarithm of this ratio, of the ratio of the energies.
Does the magnetic field energy density, though, include the fact that you need to accelerate particles up to 10 to the 16 or 18 eV? Because usually, for like AGNs, you demand higher magnetic fields just to get the acceleration, higher energies, or combine things in the region or whatever.
This is to 10 to the 20, not to 10 to the 16.
To 10 to the 20, I mean, that includes the acceleration time constraint or whatever to get to that energy.
This is from the acceleration time.
Okay.
Well, the acceleration time and the argument, the luminosity argument are exactly the same. They're not different. The acceleration time, the confinement time, the luminosity, they're all exactly the same. They're equivalent to each other. It's not a different argument. Yeah.
Just curiosity, I started from quantum to modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Epsilon B over epsilon E was something like 10, like 100. So why did you start?
In the afterglow. He's thinking of internal shocks of reverse shock.
Because you put on the afterglow.
Well, this is what, okay, let me tell you two things. One is, I think that, okay, as I mentioned a few slides back, in most of the cases in the afterglow, we have one frequency missing, which is the self-absorption frequency. And not knowing that gives a large uncertainty in the magnetic field and in the number density. So I think that invariably, whenever you have a good handle on all the parameters, the magnetic field energy density is not very far from equipartition. The very low values, which are sometimes quoted in Panatescu and Kumar, are invariably related to the cases where you don't know this frequency. So the relevant question is to ask, what is the error bar that they put on this number? They don't do it at all, of course, but there is at least one example where they've done this analysis and got a very low magnetic field, 10 to the minus 5, and then there were radio observations that allowed to determine this self-absorption frequency, and the magnetic field jumped to equipartition. So you have to be careful with within, although they are not directly related to this, as Peter said, I think they are not directly related to GRBs either.
And the second question was, why the condition in the afterglow should be similar to the condition from
the... Okay, so this is not for the afterglow. So you can ask Peter about this. So they have done this analysis of some case of reverse shock emission.
Okay.
And for those analyses, what they find is actually this, you find these two things. From the reverse shock emission, you get a lower limit on this and on this. And this applies to the magnetized plasma that was emitted by the source. Okay. So it's...
The conclusion here is interesting. I mean, if the field is produced by the source, you need the 10-15 gauss at the source, or else...
No, it can be generated.
If you generate it's more interesting. But I mean, if you just, let's say, approximation conducted from the source, then you need the 10-15 gauss at the source.
That's right, if it's conducted from the source. But even if it's much lower than this, it will not be a large fraction below equipartition. So I think that it's more of a puzzle to explain the strength of the magnetic field in the afterglow than in the prompt phase. There you need much, much larger amplification. In the afterglow, the interstellar magnetic field is many orders of magnitude below. So then you need huge amplification in order to get this epsilon B to be close to 1.
So what values in the gauss do you need in the afterglow?
So it depends on the radius. But it should be tens of gauss initially, or hundreds of gauss.
Hundreds of gauss. Initially,
when you start decelerating, just begin the deceleration
of the
outflow. If you want, you can easily estimate what it should be, if you want the number, right? Because you need the energy density behind the shock is gamma squared times n times mpc squared. This should be this b squared over 8 pi. Okay, so this is 100. This is, let's say, 1. And this is 10 to the minus 3 ergs. Okay? So multiply by 8. So this is 10 to the 4. So this is 10. This is 100. And the square root is going to be roughly 10 gauss initially. Okay? Okay. I just want to show you this comparison of the two. What happens if you take a cosmological distribution of sources of protons with this amount of energy and this spectrum, this is what you get. The flux of cosmic rays as a function of energy, the dashed line, is what you would get from this type of sources. And so this is differential flux multiplied by some power of the energy, and this drop in the flux here, the suppression in the flux here, is due to this Grisen-Stepin-Kuzmin cutoff that I've mentioned in the lunch talk, okay? And in this model, the cosmic rays below roughly 10 to the 19 are dominated by galactic heavy nuclei. And so what you do is, to get this curve, you take the extragalactic protons, you take the fly's eye fit to the galactic heavy nuclei component, you combine the two and you get this curve. So this is not this is not what you're mainly interested in. The point is that you get a good handle on the rate at which energy should be produced in order to account for this flux, and this is the total energy in this case, integrated over 3 decades of the energy. Okay. So I think I'm almost out of time. So I'll mention where the neutrinos come in. So we have these jets, and presumably the accelerated particles to high energies. And as I mentioned in the beginning, protons can interact with photons to produce charged pions, which decay to neutrinos. The threshold energy, this is somewhat above the threshold. This is for delta resonance, but it's roughly 0.1 GeV squared. So the proton times the photon energy should exceed this threshold. There is an additional factor of gamma here because of the Lorentz boost. The proton energy and the photon energy in the rest frame are smaller by a factor of gamma compared to the energies at which we measure them. So if you take the typical parameters, 1 MeV photons, Lorentz factor of 300, you find proton energies in excess of 10 to the 16 electron volts would interact with MeV photons to produce neutrinos. And the pion takes roughly m pi over mp of the proton energy, and each of these neutrinos takes roughly 1/4 of the pion energy. So in total, each neutrino gets roughly 1/20 of the initial proton energy. So this would give a few hundred TeV neutrinos. Okay, this is where the numbers come from. The only thing that you need to worry about is what fraction of the energy goes into the pions, and this is typically 20%. So if you take this neutrino flux that I've derived on the blackboard, in the blackboard launch, and multiply that by 20%, you get the flux of neutrinos from this exercise, which would be 10 to the minus 8 GeV per square centimeter seconds to radian for the muon neutrinos. And as I've mentioned also in the launch board talk, this flux would give tens of events in a kilometer square detector. So you would get tens of muons induced by neutrino interactions in a kilometer square detector. And this would be a completely background-free experiment. Right, there's a lot more work about the neutrino emission from GRBs. I've listed here some of the papers, including some reference to some papers that have a different, somewhat different picture about this and much more optimistic, I would say. But I would stick to the less optimistic, more realistic models.
No, we're never optimistic.
Okay, I think you're too optimistic. Anyway, so you expect the messages, if there are protons in these jets, and then you would expect detectable signals of 100 TeV neutrinos, and there are other signals that I don't have time to discuss in such a short talk. Well, it's a talk that needs to cover many different subjects. So, the basic summary is we know that gamma bursts are relativistic jets. We know roughly their energies, and we know the Lorentz factors roughly. We know the opening angles. I've tried to show you that it is at least suggestive that there are also sources of very high energy particles. They can account for the flux of cosmic rays above 10 to the 19 electron volts. These models are predictions for what should be seen by the next generation cosmic ray detector that I've mentioned in the large lunch talk. So Auger would be able to test the predictions of the cosmic ray predictions of this model that I didn't have time to discuss. The exciting thing, I think, is this neutrino emission. Again, as I mentioned in the lunch talk, you need kilometer scale detectors in order to detect them, but they are being built. Currently being built in the South Pole and will be built hopefully also in the Mediterranean. And in addition to identifying the sources of these high energy cosmic rays, there would be a unique probe to the physics of the GRB jets. As you all know, you have AGN jets with observations over many wavelengths over many years. You still cannot say whether they are dominated by magnetic fields or plasma or baryons and so on. So these neutrino observations are going to provide the unique information on these sources. The other point is that these neutrinos would come from fairly small distances along the jet where we don't have much information from photons. And I should mention also, again, although I didn't have time to talk about this at all, that even with a relatively small number of neutrinos, we can get very interesting constraints on the basic neutrino properties. So this would be an additional bonus to these neutrino experiments. OK, I'll stop here.
Is this kind of an upper limit on the number of neutrinos you would expect? I mean, just being kind of devil's advocate, you know, if you have an EZK cutoff in the end, you don't have these post-cutoff events, and you know, you only can allow kind of, you know, a certain component of, you know, these above 10 to the 16 EV per
protons. And it, to me, the fact that you have high energy electron acceleration doesn't necessitate that you have proton acceleration to a still higher energy. And I know that there are, you know, losses and things like that are very different, but I don't really see anything that demands that, you know, you have even 10 to the 16 eV protons present either from, you know, from either the diffuse cosmic ray background or from, you know, the observations. I mean, it seems allowed. It seems an interesting possibility. But is there anything that any compelling thing that argues for the presence of 10 to the 16 eV protons or above?
So let
me know if I see it.
Let me see if I understand the question. So what is the question?
Two sides. Why do you need even 10 to the 16 eV protons in a gamma reverse? One argument would be, well, this is a way of explaining some excess in the, know there are cosmic rays at that high energy, and this is one way of explaining them. The other way of doing it might be something based on the source itself, that you could tell me, that I don't know of anything based on the source itself that tells me that, you know, I have to get protons up to that energy.
Jim, the prize is to solve the puzzle of the origin of the high energy cosmic rays.
Did you see the small contribution that bump was making?
What?
It was just a teeny little bump on top of the pump.
Again?
Look, you've got the other stuff, right?
This is dominating. This is more than 50% of the flux here and 100% of the flux here.
Okay.
This is not a tiny bump over the. What do you mean a tiny bump over the power law?
I just don't see that there's that dashed.
The dashed line is not data. It's what you. This is the dashed line, is what you would get if you assume that there were no GZK suppression, no interaction with the CMB, okay, and extending the power law from these energies to high energies.
Why does it?
Okay. This has nothing to do with that. Your question was, why?
Adding a bump to some other component that already has to be there that's falling off, right?
Okay, so you see that this flux here the flux here is completely dominated by this component. It's not a tiny bump on this flux. It's almost 100%. No, but so I didn't plot. Maybe I should have plotted this component, the galactic heavy nuclei. The galactic heavy nuclei goes like this here. Okay? So this was the source of the confusion.
Okay. Yeah. But then, from the other standpoint, why do you need 10 to the 16 eV protons?
If you ask me, is there direct evidence from electromagnetic observations for the existence of 10 to the 16 electrovolt cosmic rays or protons anywhere,
yeah,
in gamma rays or anywhere? Right. The answer is no.
Right.
We have no evidence from anywhere in the universe that for sources that accelerate them.
Sorry.
Although we do see them.
Right.
So
that's the
It seems to me an important element of producing the ultra high energy cosmic rays is that you simultaneously accelerate electrons and protons in ultra relativistic shocks.
It's not ultra relativistic.
Hmm?
The shocks are not ultra relativistic.
Lorentz factors of 100.
So the afterglow. As I mentioned, we go back. We're not talking about this place, but this place.
That's right. So they're ultra-relativistic.
The plasma moves ultra-relativistically, but in the plasma frame, the shocks are not so relativistic.
So you're doing it in the internal.
Right. Yeah. That's right. And many times, there's all sorts of criticism related to this here,
so in the internal
which
shock,
may
you have a mixture of electrons and protons.
Right. Yeah. And this criticism may or may not be valid for these shocks, but it's certainly not valid here.
Okay. You say nothing about TV gamma rays. It's interesting. Is it possible to expect something? Is it possible to have gamma rays in TV?
Yes. Yeah. So I didn't say anything about this. I wouldn't have time to also talk about TV gamma rays. But there are two issues. One, most GRBs are very far, so TV photons will be absorbed. So only very nearby ones. But if you go down, let's say, to lower energies, let's say 50 GeV or 30 GeV, maybe there is a chance to see some events which are close enough. And then I think, yes, you should be able to see these photons at least on the minute time scale after the burst. Yes.
Let me just add one comment to that. I mean, they have to be there if they're not absorbed. You know, in a huge huge factor, more of them than the neutrinos at the source before they're absorbed. Because, you know, if you compare effective areas in the neutrino instruments and the gamma ray instruments, there's many orders of magnitude more effective area in the gamma ray instruments than one pi naught to every pi plus or minus. You've got a lot more of them at the source. The real question is whether or not they're absorbed. And that's, if you have to absorb them like mad to not see them, and that's quite likely given the proton fields and so on. But they're definitely produced. If you see neutrinos, gamma rays must be produced orders of magnitude more powerful. So
that's why you don't call them neutrinos.
No, but I mean,
so that the answer I gave was taking this thing into account. And therefore, I mentioned minutes timescale. I think that in the prompt emission, it's very difficult to for TV photons to escape. So what you want to do is to look at the early afterglow, minutes timescale of the afterglow. Then you should have these photons, and they should be able to escape. And if the burst is close enough, they should also be seen.
I want to ask a pessimistic question.
You mean after his optimistic question?
Okay. I'm sure it's irrelevant, but if the neutrinos are not affected, what would be your conclusion regarding the ultra-high-energy cosmic?
So it depends on the level at which they would not be detected. So if you can really show that they are not produced here, then I think it would be a problem for these models. Yes.
No, I think the Doppler factor can always be made bigger.
Yeah, as I said, you are much more optimistic, but I'm trying to be more realistic.
The Doppler factor is too large.
If the outflow was pointing flux dominated, would there be internal shocks?
This is a good question. I think if it's dominated by pointing flux, we don't exactly know what the mechanism that would lead to dissipation and radiation production
you
is.
You still have to produce pairs.
Yeah.
But then you
don't
get ultra energy
cosmic.
That's right. There wouldn't be neutrons. Right. No, I think that's a misconception. If it's pointing flux dominated, you don't know what the it can be. You know, baryonic. It's high sigma. You dissipate magnetic energy. You remember, it's baryon. You know, baryon content.
So
it doesn't mean that if it's pointing flux dominated, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's.
I think Pidrush. I guess Pidrush was asking what it is. A pure pointing flux. No baryons.
No, but there has to be baryons in it, of course.
But wouldn't it be less kinetic energy from the collision if you have two things moving at different velocities and they come together, and if they're protons or if they're some light plasma, isn't there a difference in the total energy budget for the internal shock just from the kinetic energy budget or something?
Difference between this and?
The two different velocity flows are coming together, then they somehow merge and they move off together. I mean, it's this thing I've seen in a paper by Katz and other people. I mean, but there's a total, you know, kinetic energy budget that you get in that internal shock merger, right?
Right.
And I would think there'd be a difference if it were a baryonic outflow compared with a pair.
Compared to pair.
There is a difficulty to make internal shocks if it's a pointing outflow. Dissipation there is more speculated to be due to, you know, the connection and so things like that. Okay. You'll always get an external shock because it's like a piston moving into the external medium. It's harder to imagine the reverse shock and the internal shock. So the prompt emission then might be, you know, something like the connection.
That's right. And you do see it in the scrub nebula.
But the point is that this is. I don't think that we can say that it would be more or less efficient. Or we just don't know. We don't know how particles would be accelerated there. I would also want to make one comment about this. I've shown this. This claims that at least that we have large magnetic fields in the ejecta and so on, based on the afterglow observations. So I should mention that. This emission from the initial interaction with the surrounding medium where you have a shock wave, it naturally fits into this picture. It is unclear how it would fit in this pointing flux dominated picture. because it's not known what to expect in that case.
Yes, this only if you have quaternion-related flux, definitely, as shown by Karamiti, Cannon, and the following, that there is no internal shockwaves. Quaternion-related flux, no internal shockwaves. But there is another mechanism which might be responsible for generation of emission. But it's extremely interesting that in this case, generation of ultra-high energy protons, not expected, because it's, first of all, it's known. Usually, it's not able to accelerate protons to extremely high energy. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to discriminate. If we have neutrino with psi energy, we have more reasonable internal shockwaves. If you have no neutrino, maybe quite dominating flux.
Okay.
Yeah, those 20 events per year coming from neutrinos are the huge fluxes. What are we talking with more than one neutrino per burst?
So you know that we have something like maybe 1,000 bursts per year. So you get 20 after 1,000. This is there.
This is more because.
This is
per burst. It's not 20. It's 20.
So you don't have the point one. You can get something like a few neutrinos.
Yeah.
Can be highly significant.
Oh, of course. It's 1 second. I don't remember. It's a few seconds. In terms of background, it's zero background.
I guess each one has to come from the source too. So even if you see a handful,
if
you still have to be correlated with
the gamma rays,
the bursts to some, you know, where there's an angular
velocity.
The time of position, time of position. If you use the fluence as the index of the power of the burst. And you assume that the MeV fluence puts a limit upon the GeV, the 100 MeV fluence, that limits the total amount of photohadron production you can have. And unless your bursts are very bright, I mean, greater than 10 to the minus 3 arcs per square centimeter, it's very hard to see anything. And then, so we get something like one neutrino for 3 times 10 to the minus 4 arcs per square centimeter fluence burst. And those only happen a couple times per year. But then the integrated value could be some perhaps tens of neutrinos per year.
Yeah, so most of the events should not produce a single neutrino. Just if you collect large enough number, you should see the
and then you rely on the time signature.
Time and spacing. Yeah.
And then you do it over a long period of time and you get a gold base for the ensemble.
Yeah, you don't need to build a case. It is really a zero background experiment. I mean, if you see one neutrino, it would still be highly significant.
But what were you learning with you turn neutrino?
If you see one neutrino,
About the jet, you can learn something. If you get tens of neutrinos, and some of them would be taus, and some of them would be nu e's, and so on, you can actually learn some things about the jet structure and so on, and things like that. But let's see. First, they need to detect some. Then you worry about this. And then you can also get limits, as I mentioned, about deviation from Lorentz invariants and all these things that you can usually get. Many orders of magnitude better than we have from supernovae neutrinos.
Other questions? If not, let's thank Ely again for